Today we're going to continue talking about regulation of blood pressure, and I tried to stress last week how important it is to maintain blood pressure, mostly to maintain flow, but other reasons as well. Just one note before we start, I won't be in my office today for my office hours, but somehow I don't get the feeling that it's going to be really that crucial. No one showed up to my office all semester, so I'm just sitting there weeping, you know, waiting for someone to show up. So, no, I can't make it today. But if you have to see me, then you can just contact me by email. Okay, so we're talking about blood pressure. We start talking about the acute regulatory mechanisms, and this is mediated mostly by the baroreceptors. We talked about the carotid sinus and the aortic arch, which are both two very important systems for the acute regulation of blood pressure. And the carotid sinus is slightly different from the aortic arch in that it gives information not only about the actual blood pressure, but the rates of change of blood pressure as well. And this is shown in this diagram from Boron, figure 22.1. You should know this negative feedback loop. It's going on continuously with each moment as you stand up, sit down, as you do exercise, etc. It's a very important mechanism. And this doesn't show up that well. I think this is from Silverthorne, but I just want to make sure you understand one concept, and that is, as blood pressure goes up, it increases the firing of the baroreceptors because they're stretch sensitive. But that increased firing in the afferent system leads to decreased firing of the efferent system, predominantly the sympathetic output, okay? And the reason for that is that an inhibitory interneuron in the medulla. So as we increase afferent signal, the frequency of the action potentials, it decreases the sympathetic output. Conversely, when we have decrease in blood pressure, decreased firing, it's increased output to the sympathetic nervous system. The parasympathetic is a little different, but the sympathetic system is the most important of the two. The sympathetic is affecting the cardiovascular system, the cardiac and the vascular systems, and it's responsible for most of the effect. So that's the acute, but the problem with the acute is that if you sustain an increase or a decrease in blood pressure that persists over a day or two, the baroreceptors will reset themselves to a new set point. And so that they have a set point of about 100 millimeters of mercury. This is your mean arterial pressure. And of course, they do adjust themselves while you're exercising so that it doesn't try and keep blood pressure constant at 100 during exercise. But if you have a chronic effect that persists over more than a day, and blood pressure, say, is elevated at 120 and is doing whatever it can to try and bring it back down, over a short period of time, the baroreceptors will reset themselves and become, in essence, non-effective in regulating acutely blood pressure. I shouldn't say that. Non-effective in returning blood pressure to its normal level. Okay? So, the baroreceptors are extremely important for the acute adaptation. In the face of chronic adaptation, though, they will reset. Now, when they reset, it still means that you have acute regulatory phenomena from the baroreceptors. But now your entire system is elevated. So if you become hypertensive, the baroreceptors are not a system to counteract that. But even though you're hypertensive, you can still have regulation when you stand up, when you sit down, when you do exercise, you still have a regulation by the baroreceptors, okay? So we need other systems. And this is the chronic mechanisms that are involved in regulating blood pressure. And these things can affect blood pressure over many months. They're ongoing. Some of them are relatively slow, but they can persist. Now, in terms of the chronic regulation, probably the most important structure is the kidney itself, but there are other hormones, or there's hormones released from other sites that are also important. So we have renal and non-renal, and I'll talk about renal first. And to do renal, I'm going to give you an overview of the renal system. You've seen it before in 205. I just want to highlight some of the critical features for pressure regulation of the cardiovascular system. I think this is from Boron. This is figure 32.1. And it shows the position of the kidneys up here and the structure of the kidney. I've already mentioned the kidney has a renal artery going into it. And today I'm going to talk about the renal artery and what happens if you have problems with your renal artery and a renal vein. And as I also mentioned before, that the two kidneys together get about 20% of your cardiac output. This is really disproportionate to the amount of energy that they consume, but it's crucial for what they do, and it's crucial for what we're going to talk about today, and that is filtration. And filtration takes place at the structure shown adjacent to this. This is in the nephron. And these are two different types of nephrons. One's a superficial one, and one's near the juxtamedullary glomerulus thing right here, these two. And they have long descending and ascending loops that protrude into this region here, into the medulla. The medulla's in here, and it goes into the renal pelvis, forms urine, and goes into the bladder through the ureter. Okay, now the vascular part of this is the system, these descending loops. This is the loop of Henle, discovered by Don Henle before he joined the Eagles. He actually was a physiologist. Don't write that crap down. These are blood vessels that surround the tubes, and this is where most of the cardiac output going to the kidneys actually is. It's these peritubular capillaries are involved in the reabsorption and secretion of substances from the blood into the tubule or vice versa. And this plays a very crucial role in modulating sodium levels, potassium levels, urea, and a host of other substances which are either cleared or secreted or whatever, regulated by the kidney in some way. And this just shows the nephron in a little more detail, and it shows one feature that's going to be an important part of our discussion today. Two nephrons here. This is figure 32.2 from boron. And it shows the glomerulus. And from the glomerulus, we have a proximal convoluted tubule right here. Goes into the descending loop, and there's a thin portion. This is a loop of Henle, ascending loop, or ascending limb, rather. And then this feeds into the collecting duct. And the collecting duct is going through the medulla and through the kidney. And to put it in perspective of the insert on the left-hand side, this collecting duct is moving fluid from the outside to the inside and eventually into the renal pelvis right here where the urine collects. Okay? So this collecting duct is traversing through the kidney from the cortex to the medulla to the inner medulla to the renal pelvis. Do you remember anything at all about this? Do you remember what the osmolarity of the cortex is? Do you remember any features of the cortex? Anyone remember? We have signs of life. Where? Right. So the kidney produces something that's called the countercurrent mechanism. And the countercurrent mechanism is one in which the osmolarity of the kidney increases from a isotonic level of about 300 milliosmoles per liter out in the cortex to a very hypertonic level of about 1200 as we move into the medulla. And this countercurrent regulatory mechanism is a means of concentrating the urine and allows for movement of water and making the urine having less water content and more concentrated. And that countercurrent system is really an integral part of the kidney and how the nephrons work. But I won't talk about that today. I'm going to talk more from the vascular point of view. Okay, so the major process that takes place is one of filtration. And filtration takes place in Bowman's capsule. Bowman's capsule is right here. We have an afferent arteriole. It doesn't show it very well. Yeah, here's an afferent arteriole coming right in here. And it forms this tuft, this glomerular tuft right in here, which is really a bed of capillaries. And it promotes exchange, because it is capillaries, designed one cell thick, to facilitate exchange between the capillaries and Bowman's capsule. This is Bowman's capsule right here. And the filtrate goes into the proximal convoluted tubule. And that which isn't filtered goes into the efferent arteriole and then into the peritubular capillaries. Okay? Now the filtration process here is identical to that we saw before in discussing normal capillaries. The Starling principles, hydrostatic pressure, plasma oncotic pressure. So these forces are controlling the filtration level at the level of the glomerulus. And this filtrate is what begins to form the urine, and then two processes act on the filtration. So we have a filtration process which results in a filtrate. And this is the dynamics that we've seen before, the capillary dynamics. And so we can change filtration by changing the hydrostatic pressure or controlling the flow rate going to the glomerulus. And that flow rate is called the GFR, glomerular filtration rate. This is the flow going to this structure right here, this capillary bed within each Bowman's capsule. Okay, now the fluid in the filtrate can be acted on by the kidney itself. It can be reabsorbed. And this is important because filtration really isn't that selective. It can't selectively remove something. It's governed by the hemodynamics of the capillary. So the things like diffusion, filtration, we talked about this process, they aren't really subject to regulation for particular substances. They move according to physical principles. Reabsorption, however, is specific for certain molecules. We can reabsorb sodium through certain sodium transporters or potassium. And this is very important. And the last process is secretion. So reabsorption is from the tubule back to the blood into the peritubular capillaries, PTC, and secretion is just the reverse. And these happen at different places on the tubule, on the nephron, depending on which substances we're talking about. Now, certain substances we don't want to reappear in the blood at all, and secretion becomes a very important process to make sure that almost all of the substance, even the stuff that escapes filtration, gets dumped into the loop of Henle or into the ascending loop and eventually into the urine. Things like urea, etc. So these three processes are very important to control the constituents of the blood by controlling the constituents of the urine. Okay, any questions on that? This is all review, right? From 205? No? All right, now the first mechanism of regulation by the kidney is called pressure diuresis. And the name is self-explanatory. Diuresis means loss of fluid. And this is governed by pressure, in this case, the hydrostatic pressure or the blood pressure. And it's sort of it's a system that's based on the GFR and the capillary dynamics. And let me just say succinctly what it is. And it is, as pressure increases, so if we increase MAP, mean arterial pressure, we see increased pressure in the renal artery, which means increased pressure in the glomerulus, in the capillary in the glomerulus. And this means increased filtration. And this means increased excretion. I'm assuming you understand the difference between excretion and secretion, but excretion means it's lost in the urine. So we increase our urine loss. The corollary of this is a very important concept to understand pressure. As we increase the excretion, meaning increased urinary output, is decreased plasma volume. Because we're taking the volume in the blood and we're losing more of it to the urine, and so the blood volume is impacted. As the plasma volume decreases, this decreases end-diastolic volume. This decreases stroke volume. This decreases cardiac output. And this decreases mean arterial pressure. So there's a very tight link between volume and pressure. And as the plasma volume increases, our blood pressure increases. This is a relatively simple system. As pressure increases, we lose more through this process of filtration at the level of the capillary. And it's shown in the next slide, and this is taken from Guyton. Let's look at the top panel first, and let's just look at the black lines. On the ordinate here, we have urinary output to begin with. And on the abscissa we have, or on the x-axis, we have arterial pressure, mean arterial pressure. And as mean arterial pressure increases, it increases our urinary output, as shown in this line. This is pressure diuresis. Now this line right here, this straight line, represents our fluid intake. So now the ordinate is either intake or output. The intake, we're assuming that we're drinking some fluid at a normal volume per day. And as our pressure increases, we have a greater urinary output. Bring our plasma volume down, and so it will self-correct. Now, in certain circumstances, pressure diuresis isn't as effective, and this curve shifts to the right here, and this would be a hypertensive case. We still have pressure diuresis, but it's less effective. It's occurring in higher pressures than previous. Okay? In the bottom panel, what shows what happens if you have increased intake. If you increase your fluid intake to the point that you increase your plasma volume, then we shift to a higher point on this curve. So the net plasma volume, which is a balance between the output, urinary output, and the intake, is a major determinant of your blood pressure. Okay? That's pressure diuresis. So relatively straightforward. It's mechanical. It's following just physical principles. It is subject to some physiological regulation. I'll talk about that later on. Okay, the next system, the more complex of these, is the renin-angiotensin system, and we've talked about this before. I've got some figures, and I'm not sure how well they show up, but let's give them a shot. This one's a bit faint, but it's reviewing things that we've already talked about before, and you've already talked about in 205, so it's largely a exercise of review. But this is the basic system. The liver produces angiotensinogen, which is floating in the blood. Renin is released by the kidney, and we're going to talk about this process today, how renin is released and controlled. But renin is the rate-limiting step in this pathway. And renin converts circulating angiotensinogen, angiotensin 1, and then an angiotensin-converting enzyme, or ACE, converts angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. And ACE is found in blood vessel endothelium, particularly in the lungs, but other places. And normally, this process is not the rate-limiting step, renin is. So however much renin is released dictates the angiotensin 2 concentration. So this is an important relationship. I'll just put it here. Renin concentration in the blood and angiotensin 2 concentration. These two are related. And then once angiotensin 2 is released into the blood, it has myriad effects. We've talked about a couple of these. The two most important are these. Angiotensin 2 is a vasoconstrictor. It acts on the arterioles, on the vascular smooth muscle cells, and it directly causes an IP3 release in the smooth muscle cells, causes contraction, vasoconstriction, increased resistance, increased blood pressure. The other major pathway is angiotensin 2 acts on the adrenal cortex, on the mineral corticoid section, increasing release of aldosterone. And aldosterone works on the nephrons to increase sodium reabsorption. And by increasing sodium reabsorption, it means the blood that's filtered at the level of the glomerulus is returned to the blood. And this is the second concept that's very important. I said the relationship between volume and pressure is a very important one. As you increase the volume, you increase the pressure. The second one is that volume is dictated to a large degree by the sodium concentration, more so than potassium or other ions. As we reabsorb sodium from the tubule back into the peritubular capillary, from the nephron into the blood vessel, water follows it. And as water follows it, it increases plasma volume. And it follows this pathway right here, except it's just the reverse. We increase plasma volume, increase end-diastolic volume, cardiac output, increase mean arterial pressure. So angiotensin II vasoconstricts, and it increases cardiac output through aldosterone and through sodium reabsorption. Right here. The other effects are relatively small compared to this. It has a direct effect on the medulla, on the control center we talked about before, to increase heart rate, stroke volume, and has an effect on ADH or vasopressin. But the two main ones are aldosterone and the direct effect on the blood vessels. Okay? Any questions on that? So the bottom line here is renin. Renin is controlling this pathway. How is renin released? How is renin secreted and what regulates it? Well, this is the structure of the glomerulus. This is Bowman's capsule right here. And this is the afferent arteriole coming in here. And it goes through a capillary tuft. And this is the efferent arteriole. The fluid that comes in here undergoes filtration. The filtrate ends up in Bowman's space and into the proximal tubule. Now, the other structure that comes into proximity with this afferent efferent arteriole is the distal tubule. Let me just go back and show you the structure right here. Here's the distal tubule. And as the distal tubule makes its way to the collecting duct up here, it comes in contact with its glomerulus. This is the macula densa, and literally it means dark spot. Macula means spot, and densa means dense or dark. This structure right here, with the macula densa from the distal tubule, we go through the ascending limb and then the distal tubule, making contact with the glomerulus, is known as the juxtaglomerular apparatus, or the JGA. And the JGA is the very basis of the renin angiotensin system. Glomerular apparatus. Okay, now let's move ahead to that slide we showed before in more detail. So here's the distal tubule from the ascending loop. So this thing is coming out towards you. It's been going, it was back there, it's coming back up, and now the macula densa you can see is making contact with these cells in the afferent and efferent arterioles. Now the structures shown in blue are the granular cells that line the afferent and the efferent arteriole, particularly the afferent. Sometimes these are called juxtaglomerular cells. These are the cells that produce renin. And when renin is released, it goes into the bloodstream, goes through the glomerulus, back out, and then circulates as a hormone to convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. The macula densa plays a role in regulating renin release. And renin release is dictated by at least three different factors that we're going to talk about. Oh, this slide kind of sucks. Let's move on. Okay, let's talk. This figure is from another textbook, but it's kind of helpful. These are the three factors that we're going to talk about that affect renin. Now, in order to understand renin and ADH and atrin natriuretic peptides, you need to understand what is the stimulus that causes them to be released. And therefore, you can understand what is their function. What are they trying to do? Renin release is regulated. Well, let's put it this way. When renin is released, it increases angiotensin II. And the effect of angiotensin II is to increase blood pressure. And it does it in the four ways we just talked about, primarily by vasoconstriction and aldosterone increasing blood volume. So since renin causes increase in mean arterial pressure, I think it's safe to conclude that renin is released when a fall in blood pressure is detected. Okay? And so a fall in blood pressure, or things associated with a fall in blood pressure, control the rate that renin is released, and the renin tries to correct that. This shows one example, a decreased plasma volume. And the decreased plasma volume could be triggered in a lot of ways, but it's going to result in a falling blood pressure. And that's seen directly here. As we have a falling blood pressure, we see, as I show in this diagram over here, as the mean arterial pressure falls, the pressure in the capillary, the glomerulus, also falls. And the effect of this So this is the first one I'm going to talk about. Decreased pressure. This is arterial pressure. Specifically, this is the aspirin arterial pressure. This results in a decreased stretch of the cells making the aspirin arterial. As shown here. And this decreased stretch causes an increase in renin secretion. And then the rest of the pathway is something that you're familiar with. So through that complex step, complex series of reactions at many different targets, at the kidney and at the adrenal cortex, etc., we get increased mean arterial pressure. Okay? So that's one mechanism. The second mechanism is shown on the left-hand side, and that is the direct effect of the sympathetic nervous system. Remember, when baroreceptors and other structures detect a fall in blood pressure, they increase the sympathetic output. So, in this case, we get decreased MAP, increased sympathetic nervous system discharge or firing rate, increased renin, and an increased MAP. Okay, and the third one, a little more complex, in the third one we have a decreased mean arterial pressure. And this affects the glomerulus. It affects the filtration pressure. So it affects the rate of filtration. And by so doing, it decreases the sodium that gets filtered. And this is results in decreased sodium in the macula densa. Let's make sure I'm following the diagram. Yeah. And this, through nitric oxide, the decreased sodium in the macula densa results in decreased nitric oxide, results in an increase in renin. And then we get an increase in mean arterial pressure. Okay, so these are three important ways in which renin secretion is regulated, all associated with a decrease in blood pressure or a decrease in plasma volume. I think I have some other slides to show this. This is from boron, it's 49.6, and it shows the entire pathway here that we talked about, plus a few other things, but this is the angiotensin II acting on the adrenal cortex, blah, 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 acting on the kidney, aldosterone is affecting secretion, etc. Okay. Now, when angiotensin II is released, we have this effect, but we can see what happens on the pressure diuresis curve. So we talked about the kidney and pressure diuresis being an important effect. When we increase angiotensin from 0 to 2.5 times normal, shown right here, we shift the pressure diuresis curve to the right. It means the system becomes less effective. And the reason is the renin is preventing loss of fluid at the level of the glomerulus. It's decreasing the GFR, and it's affecting the rate at which fluids are filtrating, and therefore loss of fluids. Okay? So that's the renin-angiotensin system, and we'll come back to it when we talk about hypertension. Because sometimes the system goes awry and people become hypertensive because problems with the renin-angiotensin system. All right. The first non-renal system we're going to talk about is atrial natriuretic peptide. Okay, ANP. The name actually tells you almost everything you need to know about it. What does natriuretic mean? Any ideas? What is natrium? Sodium. Right. That's why sodium is called Na. So natrium is a Latin word for sodium. And in some countries, they still call it natrium. In Japan, for example, they call sodium natrium. But the second part of the word is related to uresis. And this means loss of through the urine. And so this results in loss of sodium in the urine. It's a peptide. It's not a protein. It's a relatively small peptide. And it originates from the atrial wall, but it also exists in other places, but it was first found in the atrium. So when this compound is released, it results in increased sodium secretion. If it's going to affect sodium secretion this way, then what do you think its bottom line is for blood pressure? We've been through the logic. Can you follow the logic? If you're going to lose sodium at the kidney, what's going to happen to blood pressure? Decrease. Exactly. So the intermediate pathways are increased sodium excretion, increased urinary output. Because remember, water tends to go with the sodium. The sodium ends up in the urine. The water goes with it. This means decreased plasma volume, and then decreased MAP through the pathway we just talked about. All right. So, by causing sodium natriuresis, it's reducing mean arterial pressure. So, therefore, what do you think the stimulus is to cause release of ANP? Did anyone say increase in pressure? Was that me? It was me, I think I said it. Okay. So we get increased MAP, and the effect is to cause increased stretch of atria, and this causes increased release of the peptide. And I think I have it shown in the next figure. Well, it's another one of those faint figures, but here we get increased blood volume. It could be due to increased pressure as well. Remember the relationship between pressure and volume. Increased atrial stretch. Increased release of ANP. And ANP has many targets, including a direct one on the medulla. But it affects the kidney by causing increased sodium excretion, both directly and indirectly. It also inhibits aldosterone. Aldosterone has the exact opposite effect of ANP. Aldosterone tries to retain sodium. ANP tries to lose sodium. So by inhibiting aldosterone, it brings about this desired effect. By increasing the GFR, the filtration rate, you increase the sodium loss. And vasopressin is ADH. Okay, so ANP is another regulatory factor produced by the atria and other parts of the body and will cause a lowering of the blood pressure in response to hypertension. Some of these things, though, take a while to have an effect because in some cases they're actually requiring expression of genes and increased transcription translation. So sometimes the effect isn't immediate, but the important thing is this is a chronic adjuster of mean arterial pressure. The other one is ADH, or vasopressin. We talked about this before. This is part of the hypothalamic pituitary complex, and ADH is antidiuretic hormone, and the name itself tells you a lot about what it does. Antidiuretic hormone means it prevents diuresis. Not diarrhea, but diuresis. And so, in so doing, it increases water reabsorption of the filtrate. And it decreases urinary volume. And the corollary to that is it increases plasma volume. And it has effect on blood pressure through the pathway we just talked about. And that is increases cardiac output. Now remember, ADH is also known as vasopressin. And as we talked about in the arterial section of this course, this also is a vasoconstrictor. This is going to increase total peripheral resistance. So ADH is increasing both parts of the equation. Mean arterial pressure is the product of cardiac output times total peripheral resistance, and ADH acts on both of these. Okay? Do you remember the stimulus for ADH secretion? What's the hypothalamus detecting to regulate how much ADH is released into the blood? Can I? Who taught you 205? Can I blame the instructor or should I blame you guys? Blame the instructor? All right. Who's your instructor?
Ryan
Dale. Let's blame Ryan. Let's spread the blame around Ryan. Okay. I bet you Ryan told you this stuff, but any takers? It's plasma osmolarity. So if osmolarity of the blood gets high, what it means is the water is in low concentration. The water in the blood is in low concentration. That's how your plasma osmolarity gets high. And the effect of ADH is to retain water and to dilute the solutes in your blood to bring osmolarity back down to 300 milliosmoles per liter. That's the bottom line for ADH. And it should be shown here. This is from the Byrne and Levy text, I believe. This is plasma ADH levels shown here on the ordinate. And on the x-axis is the plasma osmolarity, and 300 is normal. As we get above 300, we can see a tremendous increase in the ADH concentration in the blood. And as ADH increases, it has its effect right here, and the effect of increasing the plasma volume serves to dilute the concentration of solutes, bringing osmolarity back in line. Okay? How does ADH work? I'm going to give you a clue right here in a second. I should have stuck this slide in here. ADH works because of the fact that we just talked about before, that the collecting duct is going through areas of increasing osmolarity as we go from the cortex to the medulla. And we have an area here of about 1,200 milliosmoles per liter. Very high osmolarity, meaning very low water concentration. ADH works on the collecting duct, right here, to increase the permeability of the collecting duct to water. And so what it means is the water, which is in high concentration in the filtrate, has lower osmolarity, can move into the cortex and into the medulla, especially the medulla, moving down its concentration gradient. And as it does so, less water remains in the filtrate. We have low urinary output, preserving the osmolarity, bringing it back to normal. Any questions on that? No questions? Okay. All right, now here is a summary of the factors that regulate the sodium concentration and water excretion. And they all have an effect on blood pressure because of the relationship between plasma volume and cardiac output. Renal sympathetic nerves, we talked about these already because they affect renin secretion. But they also affect the GFR. So if the renal sympathetic nerves are activated through the vasomotor center, they increase renin secretion and has an effect of increasing blood pressure. They also decrease the rate that blood is filtered, the GFR. Can you think of a reason why a sympathetic or how a sympathetic nerve would decrease the flow of blood in the afferent arterial and therefore decrease the rate of filtration? Sympathetic nerves, afferent arterial. Do you need more clues? Not working muscles, but it's being shunted somewhere else. And why is that? What's happening at the afferent arterial because of the afferent discharge, the efferent discharge from the sympathetic nervous system? What does noradrenaline do on an arterial? Vasoconstricts. So we have decreased flow going into the glomerulus, decreased flow into the afferent arterial. So because the vasoconstriction here results in decreased filtration, and as a result of decreased filtration, we get increased fluid retention. Less is filtered, more is retained. The second effect is renin secretion. This is the renin-angiotensin system, which we just talked about, angiotensin 2, blah, blah, blah. It has a secondary effect on ADH. ANP, decreased renin secretion. We talked about some of these effects right here. And ADH increases water reabsorption by the collecting, or absorption by the collecting duct, by increasing the permeability of the collecting duct to water, allowing water to move out of the collecting duct into the interstitial space because of the very strong concentration gradient. Now, this just shows you how effective these urinary systems are, how effective the kidney is. In this example, the baroreceptors are eliminated, and cardiac output is increased by a transfusion. So the blood volume is increased, so the cardiac output is increased by more than a factor of two, almost threefold increase in cardiac output, right at this point right here. Plasma volume is increased, blood pressure increases. You can see it right here. Here's arterial pressure. Mean arterial pressure goes from 100, this is 100 millimeters of mercury, to over 225. This is a disaster. Remember, the baroreceptors are toast. They have no idea, or if they do have an idea, they can't communicate this idea to the medulla. But the urinary output increases through all of the mechanisms we talked about. Renin-angiotensin system, ADH, ANP, they all affect these one way or the other. The result is to increase diuresis and decrease plasma volume, and as we do so, decrease arterial pressure. And the time frame here is relatively quick. It's within an hour or so. So even though we talk about the renal system being a chronic effector of blood pressure, it has some immediacy to it. It has a relatively speedy response as well. Some of the things that happen to the kidney take a long time because, as I said, they involve transcription translation of proteins at the nephron and other places. But some of these things happen right away, like GFR. It's an instantaneous effect. As you increase GFR, you increase the filtration. Okay? Now, this is a bit of a complicated slide, but it shows a couple of things. So just persevere here. First thing you need to look at is on the x-axis here is a time frame, and it's not expressed in a linear fashion. It's sort of logarithmic. So we've got seconds here and minutes and hours and days to infinity. So important to stress, this is not a linear time scale. On the ordinate, we've got the maximum gain of the various systems that we're going to talk about. In the large red line right here, first of all, we have an acute change in blood pressure right here in this little window right here. And as we do so, these various systems come into play. They're invoked by all these pathways we talked about to try and rectify this. The baroreceptors respond first and foremost. And you can see the baroreceptors have a tremendous gain, almost an instantaneous response, and the effect here is over within a day or two. The scale right here is 1 or 2 days. The baroreceptors no longer respond to the change in blood pressure because the baroreceptors change their set points. So they respond right away, but over a period of time, if you keep this elevated blood pressure, they will adapt. Chemoreceptors I didn't talk about, but we have the renal system right here, and the renal system, you can see the magnitude of it in terms of its gain is many times that of the baroreceptors. The response time often is slow, maybe 8 hours, although some components, like I showed in the previous slide, can take place within an hour. A lot of these systems take longer, including aldosterone, etc. Aldosterone works by changing the expression levels of proteins in the nephron. But we have a very important, very large, high-gain system with a relatively slow onset. Okay. So that was regulation of mean arterial pressure, a lot of factors involved. Let's just talk about when blood pressure systems go awry. And I'm going to focus on hypertension, although hypotension is also a disaster. We talked about hypotension in various circumstances, like orthostatic hypotension when you stand up. People taking Viagra and nitroglycerin at the same time become hypotensive. And when you're hemorrhaging, you become hypotensive. In some cases, they can be lethal hypotension, shock. But I'm going to focus on hypertension because it's so prevalent in our society. What is hypertension? Well, first of all, the definition, and it's kind of loose, the definition is that your systolic and diastolic, either or both, have to exceed 140 over 80. 140 over 90. So greater than 140, greater than 90, and of course if you have both of these greater than these values, then you have some serious consequences. And there's a tremendous debate over which of these numbers is more important in terms of the pathology. Is systolic pressure or diastolic pressure more important to invoke the kinds of changes that hypertension causes? But that's sort of a working guideline. What's the problem with hypertension? Well, hypertension, as we've talked about before, can have disastrous consequences. We've talked a lot about effect of hypertension on the heart. So one of the first side effects is hypertrophy. And of course, if we're talking about systemic hypertension, we're talking about left ventricular hypertrophy, and if we're talking about pulmonary hypertension, we're talking about right ventricular hypertrophy. But the bottom line is the hypertrophy in general is not a good thing. So if you look at these studies like the Framingham study and other studies, they've followed people for decades, literally decades. The Framingham study started in the 50s, and they started looking at various cardiovascular parameters, and they started following these people when they died, how they died, why they died, etc. And one thing that came out of it, well, there's many, many things that came out of it, but in general, cardiac hypertrophy is one of several indices of predicting premature cardiovascular failure. So hypertrophy by itself is not a good thing. If you remember the cardiac myocytes we talked about, whether we go from a mouse or an elephant, they have sort of a common design, common size. And hypertrophy is violating this, and when it happens, things go awry. Now we can have mild hypertrophy, which isn't so bad, but persistent, large hypertrophy in the myocytes is often a hallmark of premature death. So that's one thing that's not so good about hypertension. The second thing is that it is a pretty good predictor of the development of premature atherosclerosis. We'll talk about atherosclerosis shortly, but hypertension, sustained hypertension, can accelerate the onset of atherosclerosis in the face of other risk factors. Hypertension can also result in increased likelihood of aneurysm, blood vessels rupturing, and this can cause strokes or MI. These are the two most serious things when a blood vessel breaks, depending whether it's in the brain or the heart. Now, of course, if it happens in a leg or something, it could result in loss of the limb, but this is not as life-threatening as it is in the brain or the heart. So these are three of the most serious consequences of hypertension. Hypertension, the problem with it is that people often don't recognize the fact that they're hypertensive because there's no real feeling associated with it. And so you have to actually monitor your blood pressure to see if your blood pressure falls within normal levels. And even to do that is not as easy as it seems. There are various factors, some things called white coat hypertension. That has to do with the fact that if someone with a white coat is in the room, your blood pressure tends to go up. And if someone's not wearing a white coat, or maybe your blood pressure, and they're wearing nothing or something, your blood pressure could even be worse. But don't write this stuff down, please. But the important consequence of hypertension can be devastating. And the thing is that hypertension is you're asymptomatic in the sense you don't sense anything. It's persistent over a long period of time, and the down consequences can be lethal. And we'll talk about treatment of hypertension on Wednesday. Any questions?